You ever hear the phrase, there's no free lunch? Well, there's something to that, because if you get a free lunch somewhere, somebody's paid for it. So it's just a fact of life. Discipleship's the same way. We as Christ followers become modern-day disciples of Jesus. And guess what? Jesus paid the price for our salvation. That's amazing grace. But it costs us something to be a disciple. One of my favorite definitions of this cross was given by a daughter of a pastor many years ago. And when walking into the church for the first time, she saw the cross on the altar. And she said, "Daddy, what's that plus sign doing up there?" Have you ever thought of it that way? A plus sign? The cross as a plus sign? If we keep that in mind as we move through the message this morning, I'll be talking about the cross. Because I'm going to talk about the cost of discipleship. One of the theologians, German theologian, back in the 40s, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, wrote a book called The Cost of Discipleship. We studied that book in seminary, and there's some other people that wrote what it costs to be a disciple of Christ. Because the discipleship is to get lost. Now, what does that mean? Well, in a way, the story, it runs this way. Think about this, a story of a fellow who went into a rundown hotel. He went up to the desk and he said to the clerk, "What does this pigsty like this cost?" And quick as a flash, the clerk behind the desk said, "Well, $5 for one pig and $8 for two pigsty." Well, in the vernacular, we might say, "Well, get lost," to a person we're tired of dealing with. Just get away, get lost. Jesus said that you got to get lost too if you're going to become one of his disciples. And he would save his life. Those who will save their life must lose it. So that's what we're going to be talking about today, the cost of discipleship. And Jesus says that that cost is primarily losing our lives in order that we might find it. Jesus didn't want us to miss what he was saying, so he said it three different ways. And I want to look at all three, that we can take these three facets of one truth. And the first facet is this, is to deny self. Now, I don't want to get into a discussion about how we have perverted this exhortation of Jesus, because Jesus is not calling us to self-deprecation, but a self-fulfillment. Jesus knew, as modern psychologists are beginning to learn, that life is found only getting outside of ourselves. And I think the best illustration of that is marriage. Marriage goes against the dominant movement of modern culture, which is that if you're going to find happiness, you only be thinking of yourself. That's how you find happiness. Think of yourself. Well, that's the advice of modern-day culture for sure, but we're bombarded by it every day. If you want to find yourself, then think of yourself. But in marriage, we take the vows of marriage very seriously. And the vows say nothing about ourselves. The vows of marriage are focused entirely on the other person. There's no contractual clause in the marriage vows, and marriage does not make love and care and fidelity to another person dependent on reciprocation. No, you vow to give yourself unqualifyingly to another human being. And that's a scary thing. You are risking your life. The charge to the couple reads like this: if these solemn vows be kept inviolate, then God will bless your marriage, grant you fulfillment in it, and establish your home in peace. What this is saying is the blessings to you are byproducts of giving to others. Now, our culture really doesn't support that. It says to think of yourself. It says think of yourself. It doesn't make commitments, especially to other people, especially lifelong commitments. It says create your own space and protect it. Well, if you got eyes to see, that prescription for misery thinking is really is. The problem is not that we don't think enough of ourselves. Our problem is that we can't get outside of ourselves. So what the church says in the marriage ritual is it's just an application of the gospel, the good news. He who would save his life will lose it, and he who loses his life will find it. That's the cost of discipleship. And that's the first facet of one of these truths is to deny self. The second facet I'd like to suggest is one truth that is expressed by Jesus in a fashion when he said, take up your cross. Again, we can't plumb all the depths of this powerful, demanding call. Suffice it to sound one great meaning. It's not Christ's cross that we are to take up. He already took up his cross, his suffering, his once and for all death, and stands alone. And it's adequate for salvation. It's unrepeatable. So we are to take up our own cross, deny ourselves, as we have already stated in the first facet. But more than that, we're to see our sufferings as sharing with Christ and his redemptive activity and victory. Now, it's a mystery. I don't understand a lot of the mysteries pertaining to the gospel. I don't understand it, but I have experienced it, however faintly. And I've seen it shiningly portrayed in others. On reflection, you might know the truth of a very old poem. And I'd like to read it to you. I walked a mile with pleasure. She chattered all the way, but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow, and where a word said she, but oh, the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me. How many of you have ever walked with sorrow? Well, I think I can verify this from my own experience, and I'm sure if we share with each other, you can share your own experience. I think it's sort of like maybe a recording angel. If there is such a thing as an angel coming down, and he records everything that's going on in our life, like I think we all have a guardian angel. And if he recorded all the things of God to visit in our homes today, and I think we're to ask us individually the names, the experiences which have blessed us and taught us the most, I think those influences would have brought the greatest enrichment to our spirit. Would it be the happy, carefree hours that the majority of us would mention? I think surely the angel's book would tell of an enrichment brought by God's great gifts of love and home and nature. The beauty of the world that we live in, and page after page would tell how trouble and difficulty and bereavement and bitter disappointment and hopes and dreams frustrated that flicker out and die. All the things which hurt leave a mark. The pages would be filled with stories of suffering that had brought blessings by imparting a new depth, new insight to the soul. This is a life-changing discovery, that our pain can be creative, that our suffering can be a part of salvation. It's part of the process that we can see our suffering as sharing with Christ and his redemptive activity, and more importantly, his victory. Because we do not have equal gifts, but we do have equal sacrifice. And I'm going to talk specifically about this word, which is relevant here. Our cross is not the cross of Jesus. Neither is our cross to be compared to somebody else's cross. It's our cross. It's our sacrifice. It's our willingness to give sacrificially of our material resources until that becomes a spiritual exercise. And this is a big issue, that our giving becomes a spiritual exercise. Are you making it so? Are you making your pledge because it's a matter of prayer? I wish there was some way to convince us of the blessings that are there, just waiting for you and I to lay hold of. Many of us are going to miss the meaning of the whole thing because we're not willing to turn our decision-making into a spiritual exercise. I think that we might miss the boat altogether if we don't turn our decision-making in all things in life a spiritual exercise. Now, the third facet of this great truth is Jesus is stating, follow me. I think this too could be an entire message another time, because we need to remember a Jesus focus here. He's telling the disciples what kind of Messiah that he is, and therefore what they are to be and to do if they are his disciples. Jesus was drawing in the net. You see the fisher people with the nets, and they draw in all the fish, and when they get them there, they throw out the ones they don't want. They keep the good ones. Jesus is separating all the serious followers from the curious tag-along crowd. He had a lot of tag-along crowd. They weren't all serious. But the disciples are those that he uses for his mission. Jesus wanted to get his disciples ready to carry on what he had begun when he was no longer with them. And we know that he's no longer here, but he is here in the spiritual sense. And what he had begun was a ministry of renewing the world through love, agape love. Not the kind of love that we think about in this world today when we use that word very loosely. He's talking about love. He's talking about following him. So if we're to follow him in a compassionate ministry, that ministry may take us in the areas of places where we aren't comfortable and where we don't want to go. It may put with us people, put them in our lives with whom we're not comfortable to be with. And it may call us to tasks that we would not choose for ourselves. During the war, there was a war correspondent, reporter, that always gets embedded with the troops and so forth on the battlefield. And this correspondent was just watching. Now, there was some nuns in that ministry, nurses, whatever you want to call them, but Catholic nuns especially. And she was unwrapping a soldier's wounded leg, because gangrene had set in, and the stench from the pus and the blood was so repulsive that he turned away and he mumbled under his breath, I wouldn't do that for $1 million. She glanced up and replied to him, neither would I. You see, because of who she was, she did not have to add, but I do it for Jesus' sake and out of love for him. That's why she did it. So here's the big truth, the demand of discipleship. We got to get lost. And there's three ways of saying it. Deny self, take up your cross, and follow him.